Well, it was just like any other summer day. I was sitting behind my desk, plunking away on my computer when my cell phone rang. A friend was on the other end of the line, and we chatted casually for a few moments. The friend had experienced more than his fair share of hardship in life, and it seemed that he could never catch a break. But finally, life seemed to take a turn for the better for him. It felt like he was kind of turning the corner. There was a glimmer of hope that his circumstances might be changing for the better. He had recently landed a new job driving a semi-truck. Decent paychecks were on their way, and things were looking up. We chatted for a few moments as he drove, and suddenly the conversation shifted. He mentioned seeing smoke and being concerned. He thought he would pull over because there just may be an issue. He pulled over, and by chance, he left me listening in on the phone line. He went to explore. I heard the truck door open, and the sound of the traffic became loud. And I listened. And then a brief moment later, everything changed. What had been concern over smoke was now panic over fire. His truck was on fire. And now he was scrambling to put it out, calling for help, flagging cars, desperately trying to save the truck, his few possessions that he owned, the only cash that he had, and perhaps his job. It was a surreal moment as I listened in on the chaos. I sat stunned as I listened, helpless and praying. And in moments, the fire was out of control and the connection was lost. And just like that, his hope was blackened. His truck was consumed. Life had took an unexpected turn for the worse. Our world is rife with misery. No one is immune to pain, turmoil, hardship in this life. This is the reality of our broken world. The devastating effects of a broken relationship with God. Whether we experience suffering directly or see it in the life of someone we know, we will get a taste of misery in our lives. It's inevitable. We'll be touched by pain, whether through disease, mental illness, addiction, violence, betrayal of a loved one, maybe rejection or abandonment, poverty, enslavement, terrorism, and of course, death. It's a reality of life in a world marred by sin. But when misery and suffering and pain invade, what do we do? When life takes this sudden turn for the worse, where do we go? How do we respond? How do we navigate the realities of misery in our world without succumbing to despair? Now, today, as we continue to follow the story of Exodus, we are reminded of the reality of pain and suffering in our world, but we are encouraged as we see God step into suffering and provide what we actually need most in the midst of it, which is his presence and his promises. Now, last week we saw that God had called Moses to be his agent of deliverance for his people who were Hebrew slaves in Egypt. And last week we saw that Moses reluctantly accepted God's call. And with the help of his brother Aaron, they began to fulfill God's command to them. Now, at this point in the story, things are looking up. Moses, with Aaron's help, has obeyed God, and they've gathered the elders of Israel. They've performed the miraculous signs that God had given them to show the people. They told them all that God had said. And the Israelites believed Moses and Aaron. And it says they responded in worship. In that moment, there was hope that was born. Now, imagine that you are one of these Israelites. For your whole life, you've known nothing but slavery, oppression, forced labor. Your family's been trapped in this existence for generations, for over 400 years. This is the only existence that you've ever known. It's an existence that's marked by hardship, by terror, by brutality. Imagine That's you in that place. It's been an unbearable burden, and there's been no relief. And then one day you hear these words. Your rescuer has heard of your misery. Deliverance from your oppressor is at hand. Your days of darkness will soon be over. Imagine that you hear that. Imagine the thought of salvation and redemption that begins to flood your mind. And imagine that the hope that is ignited in your heart as those words echo in your ears. But just when you thought the tables were turning in your favor, life takes turn for worse. The hope that you expect is extinguished. We're in Exodus chapter 5, page 48 in the Pew Bibles. And we're going to start in verse 1. And it says, afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. But Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and moreover, I will not let Israel go. Then they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. But the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens. And Pharaoh said, behold, the people of the land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens. The same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen. He said, you shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks, as in the past. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the number of bricks that they made in the past you shall impose on them. You shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry, let us go and offer sacrifices to our God. Let heavier work be laid on the men, that they may labor at it, pay no regard to their lying words. So in obedience to God's call, Moses and Aaron, they approach Pharaoh, and they boldly proclaim God's command to let the Israelite people go so that they may worship. Pharaoh promptly responds with a question. He says, who? Who is this Yahweh that you speak of? Who is this God that I should obey? Moses and Aaron, I do not know Yahweh, and I certainly will not let this people go. Now, Pharaoh's response should not really surprise us at this point. Here he is, perhaps the most powerful person in the world, and in walk two foreigners from among the slaves, and one of them is guilty of treason and murder. This Hebrew rabble stands before them and demand the release of the country's entire workforce. All in the name of this unknown deity, Yahweh? If you think about it, the situation is nothing short of preposterous. It's laughable. In light of this, it's not hard to imagine why Pharaoh would reject the request. It was ludicrous. It was insane. Now, Pharaoh's response is worthy of note. Because in his response, he raises a question that is of utmost importance. It happens to be the question that is central to the whole story of Exodus. The question is, who is God? Who has ultimate authority? Who has ultimate power? Who is in control? To whom does everything belong? This is the central question of the story. Philip Ryken comments on Pharaoh's response in this way. He says, with these words, Pharaoh posed the central question of Exodus. Who is the Lord? Who is the one true God? Who is the supreme deity who alone has right to demand praise from every creature? This is the primary question for both Israelite and Egyptian. And it's the primary question for the readers of the book as well. As much as this question, who is God, mattered to them, It matters now. It matters for us. Because like Pharaoh, when it comes to submitting to the one true God, we are inclined to ignorance and arrogance. Sin blinds us, and sin stirs up pride in our lives. It's important because like Pharaoh, we are prone to delusion. We believe that we're the center of life, that everything revolves around us. Like Pharaoh, we too want to remain in control over the throne of our lives, protecting the kingdom of self because we believe that that is the key to our happiness. And like Pharaoh, as we are confronted with the truth and faced with the reality that we are far less impressive than we think, we too will come to realize that we have no true power, that control is an illusion in our lives, and anything we think we claim as our own will one day rot, burn, or be left behind for somebody else's enjoyment. The question matters just as much now as it did then. Who is God? So as we reflect on that, what do we discover? What do we discover about ourselves? As we ask ourselves that question, do we begin to discover that there are idols in our lives? Or perhaps we're inclined to maybe just minimize the statement, who is God? And well, maybe we'll just redefine God a little bit in such a way that he requires less of us. Who is God? Well, he's kind of like a co-god, really. We share the throne of our lives. The question matters. Who is God? So how will we answer that question in our lives? What is the reality of that? Who do we serve? Who's in control? Let's continue reading. Exodus 5, we're going to be in verse 10. So the taskmasters and the foremen of the people went out and said to the people, "Thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go and get your straw yourselves wherever you can find it. But your work will not be reduced in the least." So the people were scattered throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. The taskmasters were urgent, saying, "Complete your work, your daily task each day," as there was straw. And the foremen of the people of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, "Why have you not done all your task of making bricks today and yesterday as in the past?" Then the foremen of the people of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, "Why do you treat your servants like this? No straw is given to your servants, yet they say to us, 'Make bricks.' And behold, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people." But he, Pharaoh, said, "You are idle. You are idle. That is why you say, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.' Now go and work. No straw will be given to you. You must still deliver the same number of bricks." The foremen of the people of Israel saw that they were in trouble when they said, "You shall by no means reduce your number of bricks, your daily task each day." So now in response to Moses and Aaron's request, Pharaoh's heart is hardened, and he tightens his grip on the Israelite slaves and makes life far more miserable for them. Their work becomes unbearable, and the Israelite foremen who oversee the brickmakers are being beaten because the quotas are no longer being met. These Israelite foremen, they find themselves caught between a rock and a hard place. They're unable to ensure the quotas because the work is impossible, and they're unable to appease these Egyptian taskmasters who are relentless in their abuse. They find themselves being punished for circumstances beyond their control, and life becomes miserable for them. So what do they do? In response to their hardship, where do they turn? Well, they turn to Pharaoh. They go to the boss. They suspect that maybe a mistake has been made, and their harsh treatment is simple misunderstanding. In their minds, they think, who better to remedy this situation than Pharaoh? He's in charge, he calls the shots, and, well, surely he cares about us. So the foremen, they come and they confront Pharaoh. And notice as they confront him, what do they say? Three times they say, "Your servants. Why do you treat your servants like this? No straw is given to your servants. Your servants are beaten." Through these words, it would appear that the Israelite foremen have a stronger allegiance to and a greater trust in Pharaoh to bring relief than they do in Yahweh. It would appear that they trust Pharaoh more than God. In their minds, Pharaoh holds the power. He's a better bet than Moses for sure, and perhaps a better bet than the one true God. See, when things get worse, they proclaim their allegiance to the king of Egypt, and this feels safe to them. And what's fascinating is that these foremen find themselves looking to the one who enslaved them to be their deliverer. Like an animal born in captivity without any sense of what it means to run free and be wild, the foremen are content to return to their cage. That seems best to them. But what may surprise us, this is more normal than we realize. In reality, we are not that different from the Israelite foremen. We too are inclined to trust things that enslave us, believing that they will deliver us. Let's call it what it is. It's idolatry. And none of us are immune to it. We all have functional saviors in our lives that we set our hope in rather than God, believing that something other than God is a better bet for deliverance, even when that something is hurting us. It could be work, could be money, success, affluence, sex, pornography, food, body image, relationships, drugs, alcohol. These can become the idols that we pursue, thinking they save us and make us feel better. But in reality, they enslave us and lead us to destruction. And yet because of sin, we are blinded to it, and we fall into the trap again and again and again. This is what the Israelite foremen were doing, believing that going back to the old way of life was the better bet because life was hard. When life takes a turn for the worse, when life becomes painful, where do we turn? I find for me a helpful question to ask is when I get stressed, when I'm afraid, when I'm anxious, when I'm feeling down, when I'm at the end of my rope, what do I turn to? What do I look to for comfort? Sometimes it's food. Sometimes it's work as an escape. As I've asked that question of myself, I've seen, recognized the idols in my own life. So what do you turn to when life gets hard? What do you look to for comfort to make you feel normal for a few moments? What do you look to for escape? Ask yourself these questions. Let's continue. Verse 20. They, the Israelite foremen, met Moses and Aaron, who were waiting for them as they came out from Pharaoh. And they said to them, "The Lord look on you and judge, because you have made a stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." So Pharaoh rejects the plea of the Israelite foreman. He dismisses them. And so what did they do? Well, they do what comes naturally. They find somebody to blame. They turned their anger, their frustration on their leaders, on Moses and Aaron. And they call God to curse the very people that God had sent into their lives. It's kind of odd. See, when their cruel master fails them, bitterness takes hold and blame ensues. This is a warning for us. We really have to guard our hearts against bitterness. Bitterness, It offers lies that are so persuasive. And its hold is so strong when you let it creep into your life. In the end, it ruins those who embrace it. Hebrews 12:15 says, "See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble. By it many become defiled." That is the destructive nature of bitterness. Bitterness whispers in our ears, and it says that justice is being served by condemning another, and that we will find satisfaction as we withhold grace and mercy from people. But as the quote goes, bitterness is like drinking poison and then waiting for someone else to die. In the end, it just consumes the one who actually holds it. See, it's easy to blame and to pronounce judgment when outcomes are not what we would expect, what we would hope for. But here's what we must remember. In the Exodus story, it was God's will and plan for things to get worse. God actually told Moses that this is how it's going to play out. Chapter 4:21 says, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you do all the miracles that I have put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go." Failure in this moment was exactly what God had in mind. This is the case in the Exodus story. And we also see this clearly in the life of Jesus. See, the disciples, they expected a Messiah who would come and conquer Rome and establish a kingdom in which they would rule alongside Jesus. But God sent a Messiah who would be rejected, humiliated, abandoned, tortured, and murdered. God's plan wasn't what the people were expecting. Jesus wasn't the Messiah they were waiting for. Here's the reality. Sometimes leaders are doing exactly what God has called them to do. And even though God has called them, success as we define it may not be the outcome we see. Like Moses and Aaron, the leaders can become the focal point of blame and judging. But it's misplaced. And we have to be careful not to allow bitterness to take root in our lives and to become finger pointers who blame everyone and everything. Because maybe this is just what God had in mind. And maybe he's actually working through this for a greater purpose. As we continue, verse 22. "Then Moses turned to the Lord and said, 'O Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people. And you have not delivered your people at all.'" Now, in contrast to the foreman, where does Moses turn? He turns to the one who has the power. He turns to the Lord. In this, he displays a growing trust in Yahweh, although it's not a flawless trust. He has his questions. He's frustrated. He's confused. He's disappointed. And he begins to wrestle and question if God can be trusted at all. Tony Merida, in his commentary, points out that as Moses turns to the Lord, he begins to question God's goodness when he asks, "Why have you caused trouble for your people?" He begins to question God's purpose when he says, "Why did you send me?" And he begins to question God's actions as he states, "You haven't delivered your people at all." Moses is growing in faith, but is still flawed, like all of us. And I think perhaps we do see a little bit of ourselves in Moses in this story, having a hard time believing that God is good when life feels anything but good. How can we rest in God's goodness when life is full of pain, when disappointment comes after disappointment after disappointment? How do we trust in God's goodness? The Apostle Paul gives us a hint. 2 Corinthians 4:17 says, "For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Now let us understand, in this, the Apostle Paul is not minimizing pain. He's not minimizing suffering. He's not saying, it's no big deal, better things are coming. He's not saying that. He's saying the pain is real. Sin is devastating. Brokenness, it's a heavier burden than we can carry. He's not minimizing it. But what he's saying, in contrast of what is to come, it's small. In contrast to the reward, the joy that you will receive as you sit face to face before the Lord, it is minute. Dorothy L. Sayers puts it this way. She says, there are certain eternal achievements that make even happiness or our worldly comfort look like trash. There are certain eternal achievements that make even happiness look like trash. So what's hard to grasp, but it's altogether true, is that even in the hardship, God is giving his very best to us. Tim Keller says, and this is paraphrased, if we knew all that God knows and could understand all that God understands, we would choose exactly what God has given us, because we would understand the value of the outcomes. But it's hard to see. There's pain and there's frustration, and it's real in the midst of it. And yet God is gracious to us even when our faith is frail. Now God responds in chapter 6, verse 1. But the Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand he will send them out, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of this land. So as Moses approached God, he asked questions that we all wrestle with when suffering touches our lives. He says, why? Why is this happening? Why me? Why is there no relief? Why have you not released us from this torment? Why haven't you acted, God? He asks why. I think this is a common question that we are confronted with. Why? God, why is it so painful? Why do you feel far from me? God, why? But notice God's response. He does not reply with an exhaustive list of all the reasons why. He doesn't give that to Moses. He doesn't outline every little detail so that Moses can understand the answer to that question. And I think this is because knowing all the reasons why will not actually ease the pain, and it doesn't actually provide what is needed for us to persevere when life gets hard. God doesn't answer all the questions why, but he does give one answer here. He says, because now you will see. Why? Because now you will see. I'm going to show you something that in other circumstances would not have happened, or would have been completely missed. I've directed these events precisely up to this point so that I can do something that will blow your mind. I've allowed the pain, I've allowed the suffering, so that I can give you something greater, something better, something more glorious. Why? Because now you will see. His glory, his power, his sovereignty, his sufficiency, his mercy, his compassion, his wisdom, justice. They would all be on display in a way that had not been revealed. In the Exodus, God was unfolding history in such a way that people could see who God is and how God saves. And it was unlike any display that he had shown up to this point. God had allowed it. God had directed it. God had ordained it so that he could show them who he is and how he saves. As God continues to respond, verse 2 says, God spoke to Moses and he said to him, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty. But by my name, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they lived as sojourners. Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the people of Israel, whom the Egyptians hold as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant. Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will deliver you from the slavery to them. I will redeem you from an outstretched arm, and with great acts of judgment. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who has brought you out from under the burden of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you for a possession. I am the Lord. Here we see that when life gets hard, God responds by giving us what we need most. A reminder of who he is and a reminder of what he has promised. He gives us himself. Yahweh is the one who is with us, and he is the all-sufficient one, fully in control, even when life takes a turn for worse, and he's able to provide all that is needed. He's all-wise, loving, and good, bringing about the very best in our lives, even through seasons of pain. He is good for his word, and he is faithful to his promises. And what is especially beautiful in this section is that the promises that he lists here, they echo the same promises that he has for us today. He says, I will deliver you from slavery and redeem you. See, Yahweh is our family champion, and he has purchased us out of slavery to sin through his son, Jesus Christ. And he's restoring us, and he's faithful to finish that work. He will redeem, he will save, he will lead us out of slavery if we look to him. What a great promise. He says, I will adopt you. He's not just saving us out of something, but he's saving us into his family. He leads us to something and to a place, ultimately relationship with him and his people. He says, I will adopt you. I will call you my own. We're family. He says, I will bring you into the promised land, and I will give you an inheritance. 1 Peter 1:4 says, Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. You can take that to the bank. His promises are true. And it's as we reflect and rest in these promises that we can persevere through our hardship and trials. God has not forgotten us, but he's promised to save us and bring us home. This is good news. Even when life gets hard, we can rest, be secure, be anchored in who God is, what he's done, and what he is doing. He is faithful, and he will not let us down. Now, I think there's a couple of applications here for us. I think first, when life takes a turn for the worse, where will we turn? To whom will we seek relief? And I hope, as we reflect on this, that we'll increasingly turn to the Lord, that we'll increasingly cry out to him, increasingly trust in his promises and his faithfulness. And the second is that as we see others who are burdened with hard circumstances, living in misery, how will we respond? See, in the Exodus, God's initial response is not to alleviate the pain of the Israelites. He doesn't bring immediate relief, but instead, he calls Moses. Where does he call him from? Well, he actually calls him from the comfort of Midian, from a land far away. He calls him out of comfort to enter into the suffering of his people. It was through Moses that God chose to bring deliverance from suffering and slavery to the Israelites. Like Moses, the greater servant Jesus, in obedience to the Father, he surrendered the comfort of heaven in order to enter into the suffering of our world. He was the means by which God would bring salvation, deliverance, to save us from our suffering. So now, as followers of Jesus, we are called to be prepared to surrender our comfort and to enter into difficulty and pain of the people that God has placed in our lives so that through us they can find relief knowing who God is, what his promises are. I think of the story of Anmar and his family. It's a beautiful picture of this. People that God has called to come alongside people who are refugees, alienated, cast out, threatened. And God calls his people to come alongside, to surrender comfort, so that he could show them new life. May we be those people. In Anmar and his family's lives, in our family's lives, in our community, our neighbors, there is far more suffering out there than we see on the surface. And God has called us to be his hands and feet, to enter in, to proclaim who he is, to proclaim his promises, so that deliverance and relief can come.